Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. In 2022, Intel announced the construction of a huge manufacturing campus in New Albany. It came with the promise of massive infrastructure and lots of jobs, and residents in Licking County were all ready to make changes for it. Then Intel hit some snags recently, slowing down their plans in New Albany amid the company's financial troubles. Then President Trump weighed in, leaving the public with more questions than answers. And then today came some more news yesterday that the Japanese company SoftBank is giving Intel $2 billion, a $2 billion lifeline. Joining us to discuss all of this and Intel's ins and outs is Max Cherney, technology correspondent with Reuters. Welcome back to All Sides, Max.
Well, thanks for having me again.
So let's start with the latest news that you reported about and that Intel's getting an investment from SoftBank. What can you tell us about this, the company? What is SoftBank and Intel doing?
So SoftBank is giving Intel a $2 billion investment to buy just under 2% of the business, which will make SoftBank a top 10 shareholder in Intel. As I think you know, Intel needs cash very, very badly. So any infusions like this are beneficial to keep the company humming along. It appears as though this was tied to talks over SoftBank potentially acquiring Intel's manufacturing facilities. The Financial Times reported this morning that there have been talks for weeks between SoftBank and Intel about that on that topic. We haven't done any reporting on it, but it appears as though there's more at work than a straightforward equity stake in the company.
Well, and then this morning, the Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, was on CNBC talking about the importance of the U.S. making its own chips so that we don't need to get support and import them from other countries. Here is some of what he said.
It would be lovely to have Intel be capable of making a U.S. node or a U.S. transistor, you know, driving that in America. That would be lovely. That's not necessary. But as I said, that would be a really good thing to have, would be American participant in the semiconductor space.
So can this money from SoftBank get Intel on the right footing to be able to do what Howard Lutnick wants them to do?
It's a start, but it's not going to pay for the entire process. These new process nodes are sort of new technology nodes that Intel uses to make advanced chips cost tens of billions of dollars to develop and take many years. I don't know the exact estimate off the top of my head, but the semiconductor capital equipment alone to make a new manufacturing process, again, that's tens of billions of dollars. So the SoftBank cash will help, but if the secretary is serious about having an American company build leading edge processors in the U.S., Intel needs more money, whether that comes from a big customer that hires it to make chips for themselves or Intel's own products remains to be seen. Historically, Intel has funded its advanced technology development with its own profit, essentially. It just was making a lot more profit years ago.
So let's catch up on some of what happened in the last week or so, because there's been a lot of Intel news. And to start, why did President Trump get involved with Intel? Why did he originally come out and call, seemingly out of nowhere, he called for Intel CEO to resign?
In April, my colleagues and I published a story about the various investments that Intel CEO Lip-Bu Tan has made in Chinese companies, hundreds in total, and some of which have ties to the Chinese military. It appears as though Senator Tom Cotton became interested in some of that reporting Lip-Bu Tan's time as CEO of Cadence, in which there was a recent Justice Department plea agreement between Cadence and the Justice Department for selling software to Chinese companies that were not supposed to be able to obtain it. So Senator Cotton appears to have been gotten interested in that, and he sent a letter to Frank Yeary, the Intel board chair, asking him several questions about Mr. Tan's ties to these various Chinese investments and what he planned to do with them if the board knew about it, the investments and so on. And roughly 24 hours after we reported the existence of this letter to Frank Yeary, the president tweeted that he, or excuse me, he posted on Truth Social that he wanted Lip-Bu Tan to resign because of all of his conflicts. So the situation escalated rather rapidly for Intel's CEO. And then several days later, he met with the president in at the White House in the Oval Office.
Yeah, did your reporting find did CEO Lip-Bu Tan actually do anything wrong in this reporting that drew the attention to people in the administration?
As far as we're aware, there's nothing illegal about making these investments. It becomes more complicated when a company is listed on the U.S. entity list, which prevents exports to such companies. But as far as we're aware, none of these investments are, breaking any rules in the U.S. anyways that we're aware of. It's a little more complicated though because Intel does business with many, many different companies around the world, and because of the sprawling ties, the sprawling nature of sort of the investment web that Mr. Tan has, there could be conflicts with in terms of what Intel, the types of business that Intel conducts, especially because many of Mr. Tan's investments have been in semiconductor companies and semiconductor related companies. That's sort of, I think, more of the nature of the concern, in terms of the conflicts. Also, Intel has an active investment arm called Intel Capital that invests in various companies, some of which Mr. Tan is involved with or is familiar with. So that creates another area where there could be potential conflicts, but nothing illegal.
Okay, so then President Trump and Tan have a meeting. I believe it was at Tan's request, and then suddenly everything's okay. President Trump says that Tan's doing a great job and everything will be fine. Is that a good summary?
It seems like it. The meeting went well, according to everybody who was involved, and it seems like there's going to be much more outreach and discussion between the administration and the Intel CEO. As far as I'm aware, they have not met before, so this was a first meeting. And as I think your listeners and you are well aware, personal relationships are important to this president. So from that standpoint, I think it was a wise decision. Other chip CEOs have made the trek to Washington or Mar-a-Lago to meet with the president, and very successfully, as it turns out, lobby for their own interests, for their company's interests. I mean, not them individually. Jensen Huang of NVIDIA and Lisa Su of AMD. They've proven that discussing what their business objectives are with the president has proven effective. So, if Lip-Bu Tan is a successful statesman, we might see action from the administration that will benefit Intel as well.
Yeah, well, obviously you do not know what Trump and Lip-Bu Tan talked about in this said meeting. But it's interesting that this news about SoftBank broke just a few days later. So do you think he sat down and told President Trump, "We're getting money from SoftBank, we're going to make chips here, give me some time."
Anything is possible. Again, the SoftBank investment is a lifeline for a company that badly needs cash at a moment when its financial situation is just not good. I mean, the executives on the last earnings call, David Zinsner, the CFO, and Lip-Bu Tan discussed the importance of fixing the balance sheet, essentially. And for a capital intensive business like I was outlining before, cash is crucial to be able to fund their expansion plans, to fund potentially Ohio in the future if they can attract a customer to fill those factories up. Of course it's possible that he discussed it there. I mean, and there may be other investments too. I mean, we have reported earlier this year that TSMC was in talks with NVIDIA and others to potentially take a stake in a joint venture that involved operating Intel's factories.
This is All Sides and Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News. And we're getting the latest updates on Intel with Max Cherney, a tech correspondent with Reuters. What is the overall, you know, before this conflict with the Trump administration, what was the overall general public opinion of Tan? Because he, you know, took over Intel, lots of financial problems. He cut staff. He cut middle managers. Overall, did people like him?
He is a less known figure than some other executives that have taken over Intel. He's been an investor in chip companies for decades. As I said, this is where his web of investments with Chinese businesses comes from. But he invests in U.S. companies as well. And the way one person I talked to in the industry put it, he probably single-handedly invested more money in chip companies than every other venture capitalist combined. So he's very deeply connected in the chip industry and in technology sort of more generally, but he's not a very public figure. He's not, for example, I'm thinking of the venture capitalist Bill Gurley, who was portrayed in a television show. Tan has never received that kind of treatment before. And it seems clear his management style is quite a bit different than his predecessor, Pat Gelsinger, who, for example, used to do push-ups before earnings calls because he had so much nervous energy that he needed to like release it before he, you know, talked to Wall Street investors about the state financial state of his business. Mm-hmm. So Tan's style, it seems so far, quite a bit different. He's addressed the company a couple of times, writ large, and he's taken a different approach to talking with the staff and talking to customers.
So Ohio residents watch the developments of Intel very closely because we here in Central Ohio have a lot of money, the state does, invested in Intel and its future. So does what happens with Tan, whether the Trump administration likes him or doesn't like him, does that matter to people living near this development in Licking County, Ohio?
Well, I think in so much as, you know, Intel has government contracts. I mean, there's a $3 billion defense related contract that they have for manufacturing, advanced chips in a secure and safe place. Then yes, of course. Relationships, I think, are very important to this administration. And I think from what we understand, the interest in Tan is whether he can effectively turn the company around. I mean, that's the multi-billion dollar question here. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, he's taken over a business that was in an enormous amount of trouble and is attempting to right a ship that could take 5 to 10 years to actually turn around. I mean, to start operating factories in Ohio, I mean, I think the discussion is 2030. So that's, you know, years from now. So this is a long haul, to turn a big manufacturing company around. And I think, you know, for what it's worth, Intel, yes, it has a chip design business and it's very successful at selling its laptop processors and so on. But at its core, it has always been a manufacturing company. Most of its employees are related in the manufacturing division in some form or another. And they're looking at problems that are, you know, 10 years out, 15 years out. Mm-hmm. So it's just going to take an enormous amount of effort that will last through several administrations, not just this current one.
Before we run out of time, you know, as we know, Intel is supposed to design and build chips here in Central Ohio, but moving on to artificial intelligence chips more generally, you had a story yesterday about a big move in the chip making world. There's a company called Arm Holdings who up until now did not build its own chips. It made the architecture for other companies to build chips, but now Arm wants to actually build their own chips. If I'm explaining this correctly, why is this a big deal for the industry, for Arm Holdings to build their own chips?
Thanks for asking about it. It's Arm, as you said, for years has been making the designs that other companies use to design their own processors, their own chips, and they're responsible for powering most of the smart mobile phones on the planet. Arm has been on a journey to try to essentially grow its business, and it's looking for different avenues, different means in which it can do so. So it's exploring the potential of building its own chips, probably an AI related chip, but its own chips. I mean, for the industry, this potentially means that Arm could compete with its own customers, And in general, just sort of reposition itself. It was once seen as like the Switzerland of the chip industry, meaning it would sell its technology to whoever wanted it. And now it appears as though that position is changing slightly. It's becoming a little bit more of an aggressive company that's not satisfied with the status quo, that wants to change its relationship with some of its customers. A very important company, but that does something kind of abstract,
Right,
if that
yeah,
makes
and
sense.
to show that it's making a power move, they hired Amazon's main chip director. So that seems like a big move. I mean, people may not have ever heard of Arm Holdings, but they have heard of Amazon. So Arm hired an Amazon guy.
Amazon has, it's worth considering that or thinking about that all of the major cloud computing companies, all the big tech companies, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Meta, all have essentially chip companies inside of them because they all make these very powerful server processors that they need to run their data centers. They're in part, they do it because they want to save money. They think they can design chips that are specifically geared towards the kinds of computing needs that they have. But also, they're in, especially for, in terms of AI chips, Amazon and others are actively trying to buy fewer GPUs from NVIDIA. They have to buy some, but they don't want to buy as many as they may have to if they don't design their own processors. It's a way of diversifying the risk, essentially, as well as, again, they think they can make processors that AI processors that can do their own computing more efficiently and at a better price than NVIDIA. And the particular executive that Arm has hired was responsible for working on Amazon's two AI related chips and spent 6 years or ish, if my memory serves, doing so. So it's a very critical sign that they hired a person who was directly overseeing, dozens or hundreds of engineers that were working on chips. So I think it's a pretty clear signal of what Arm is planning on doing.
Well, I want to thank you for catching us up on the latest with Intel and in the chip industry. You've been listening to Max Cherny, tech correspondent with Reuters. Thanks again, Max.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we're going to talk about how to talk to your kids about climate change. And that's when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
RFK Jr. has canceled close to $500 million in research funding for mRNA vaccines, the technology used for COVID-19 shots. He says it's ineffective, unsafe, and unethical, but health officials and researchers are concerned. What is an mRNA vaccine? How is it different from other types of shots? And what does the future of vaccine research look like? That's tomorrow on All Sides with Amy Jarovich from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jarovich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. The images of floods in Texas that swept away roads, bridges, and houses were startling. But what truly grabbed the world's attention was the summer camp. Floodwaters rose quickly and swept away many buildings at Camp Mystic. At least 27 campers and counselors died. And while the damage is still being cleaned up and the failures are being investigated, there are parents out there who still need to send their children to summer camp. And those children have questions about why such massive flooding is happening. Today, we're talking about extreme weather events and how to talk about them with your children. Joining us now is Laura Shifter, senior fellow at the Aspen Institute, where she founded and directs This is Planet Ed, an initiative educating the next generations on climate solutions. She's also the co-author of a book, Students, Schools, and Our Climate Moment, Acting Now to Secure Our Future. It's a framework for climate action in schools. Welcome to All Sides, Laura.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy.
So you came to our attention because you recently wrote a piece for Time Magazine, and it was titled, "Floods Are Becoming More Common. Here's What I Tell My Daughters." What first motivated you to write this letter?
You know, I think what really motivates me to write this letter, it's been an issue that I've been grappling with for several years since I had a climate moment myself as a parent about 6 years ago now, when I was playing in the basement with my three children and got news alert after news alert after news alert. We had a decade left to address climate change to avoid the most devastating impacts. And I was looking at my three children in the basement playing, you know, their games. And it was in that moment I realized the misconceptions that I had about climate change, that it was a far off problem, that it was something for people within the environment to handle, were wrong, and that this was an issue that was going to fundamentally shape my children's futures, and it is currently shaping their lives today. And basically since that moment, I have dedicated my work to figuring out how we can communicate about climate change to our children to help them understand the world that they are growing up in. And this letter is just one of a series of ways that I have been thinking about talking to my own children and trying to help other parents understand how they can talk to their children about climate change and everything that's going on around us as well.
I want to read a paragraph from your Time Magazine piece. It says, "The harsh reality of parenting today is this. Our children are living in a changing climate, above average rainfall, once in 100-year storms, severe drought, and record-breaking heat are a part of your present and future. What my generation perceived as extremes, you will know as average. What we perceived as volatility, you will experience as your norm." So when I read something like that, it's just, it seems so sad to think of, you know, these extremes becoming average and that, and, you know, massive floods and really bad hurricanes being the norm. How do you see younger generations adapting to climate change?
Yeah, so I think it's really hard to take it all in and see that as the reality. But us failing to do that means that we're going to fail to prepare our children for success. So we have to first acknowledge the fact that things will be different for our kids. We have moved into a period of climate instability. And rather than ignoring it, we can actually think about what we can do to predict that instability and help equip them to be more successful. So whether it's, you know, thinking about not having camps located in flood zones, whether it's, you know, as we're thinking about building new school buildings, making sure that they're not located in flood zones that are projected today or flood zones that are in a risk 10 years from now. And we need to be talking to kids more about how to stay safe. So even if it's the fact that extreme heat is becoming more common, how are we equipping our kids to know early signs of heat illness and when they feel dizzy or they get a headache, what are the steps that they're taking to get themselves to cool down? All of these things are really essential in helping children live well today and into the future. And we have the opportunity to equip them with that understanding as long as we're willing to get past our own grief. We feel the grief as we see the instabilities that we're facing, but we have to get past it in order to help them succeed.
So what can parents do at home to help mitigate the effects of climate change? Because I feel like I grew up where with people just constantly saying, oh, reduce, reuse, recycle, everything will be fine. So what do we need to continue to do that? Tell our children to reduce, reuse, recycle, or something else?
So I think the first and most important thing for parents to do is to start learning a little bit more about it. There's a lot that people don't understand about climate change. A lot of us adults never had the opportunity to learn about climate change in school. So being willing to say, maybe this is something I don't know a lot about, and going and learning a little bit more would be step one. I would say starting the conversation with your children would be step two, and helping them understand, you know, how our world is changing and what is different. And then step three is kind of figuring out what makes sense for you and your family. And it might not look the same for every family. There might be families where composting is something that they can really do in their home because their community supports composting. So they can learn how to reduce their food waste by actually composting it. Another family might be able to get an electric car, and that might be the choice that they make. And so it's really about thinking about what's best for you and your family. But one of the biggest impacts that you can have is actually push for broader change. So one of the things that I would encourage parents to do the most is starting these conversations, not just in their homes, but then also taking them to your children's schools and asking, what are your schools doing to reduce their impact? How are they thinking about adapting to climate change? Because ultimately, we need individuals and systems to act, and showing your children how you can make a difference in your community by making a difference in your school can be really empowering.
So, what are some things you do at home to mitigate climate change? I'm guessing you mentioned composting as an example. Is that something you do?
Composting is something we do. We also have solar panels on our roof. It was interesting. We couldn't offset our solar entirely. And so we weighed the decision a lot around whether we would get solar panels or not because they didn't offset our entire electricity use. But seeing research about how when you put solar panels on your house, you actually encourage other people to think about putting solar panels on their house as well. We decided to go ahead and do it, and we've seen other people in our neighborhood now have solar on their homes. Likewise, we've seen more people composting in our neighborhood. We do have electric cars that we drive. And so these are steps that we have taken. And one of the biggest things that I've done is I work with my children's school to actually help our school really think about what they can be doing to reduce environmental impact. And we've gone to zero waste lunch in our school building and have really challenged what we're able to do in our schools too.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we're talking with Laura Shifter, Senior Fellow at the Aspen Institute and co-author of the book Students, Schools, and Our Climate Moment, Acting Now to Secure Our Future. She also wrote a Time Magazine article titled Floods Are Becoming More Common, Here's What I Tell My Daughters. So I'm not sure how old your daughters are, but did they read your letter in Time Magazine?
My oldest one read it. She is 12. My middle one is 10. She also read it. My 7-year-old, I have different conversations with, which we talk about climate change, and she is actually pushing for changes within her school as well and has put signs up all around her school. But the two older ones read it.
So, how did they respond to you? What did they think when they read it?
You know, we talk about climate change a lot. So I think the idea of the fact that we are moving towards instability is a normal conversation for us to have in our home. So that is not shocking to them. I think they were very sad to hear about, obviously, what happened in Texas at Camp Mystic. And I think having open conversations about, you know, the harsh realities that kids are facing are important, but then providing pathways to help children know what adults are doing to help keep them safe are also important. So, reading the letter in isolation is not what my children have done. It's more the conversations around it. It's understanding the ways our world is changing and how we all need to start talking about this more if we're going to advance the solutions that we need at scale.
So you mentioned the ages, 12, 10, and then 7. So at what age should children start learning about climate change? How young is too young?
So I think there are multiple stages in which children are going to develop their climate learning. And even at a really young age, you can start having some of these conversations. One of the first and most important things to help children understand is that we are a part of our Earth systems and we depend on our climate to thrive. Earth is our home, it's our shared home. And I think for a lot of us adults, maybe we don't always see it that way. We think we can control Earth or we can control our climate, but that is not, in fact, the case. We depend on our climate to do the things that we love to do, whether it's going out and watching a baseball game, or being able to ski in the winter. And building that understanding with our children that we depend on nature and that we're a part of this broader system should be happening as early as 2 when you're going outside and you're exploring nature with your kids. So there are these stepping stones that you can build in with children. But also, children are not passively experiencing the climate impacts in our lives. My 7-year-old was 5 when wildfire smoke from Canada forced the children inside during the school day. Their field day was canceled. They were all forced to stay inside because our air became too dangerous to breathe. And that was something she could have just experienced and, let her navigate that on her own. Or even as a 5-year-old, you have questions about it. This wildfire smoke is coming down. This stuff is happening more frequently. These are the steps and the things that we can do to stay safe. And so there are different ways that you can kind of developmentally build an understanding of climate over the course of multiple years.
In your piece, I mean, you talk about flooding mostly because that was what started the article was what happened with Camp Mystic. But you also mention hurricanes happening more often. And so I think you and I might be similar in age because you said that like Hurricane Andrew sticks out in your head for, as like the one. And then there was Katrina, but there's just so many more now, and they're all just as bad or worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, wildfires are similar. Like, I don't remember much about wildfires when I was growing up, except for Smokey Bear's reminder that only you can prevent forest fires. And my kids have, been forced inside because of wildfire smoke. They had a friend lose their home in the Palisades fire. There's a lot that our children are experiencing, and it is a different childhood than you and I experienced. And we need to have these conversations to help them know these things are happening, they're more likely to occur, but collectively we can work on solutions together to help make sure that you have a safe, healthy childhood.
I spent a lot of my childhood being told, to always shut the lights out, right? Like don't, but it was more, I always saw it more so as trying to save my father money rather than save the world. So how do you shift that mindset where it's like we're shutting the light out for to save electricity, but it's not just about our electric bill?
Yeah, I think it's, helping children understand the 5 main sources of our emissions causing climate change: transportation, energy, food, buildings, and manufacturing. There are ways to talk about each one of those with kids and kind of thinking about what might make sense for you and your family to start reducing your environmental impact, and how you can push those out. So I think, one of the metaphors that we use a lot with our children is trying to help them understand that our Earth has an atmosphere around it that acts like a heat-trapping blanket, and it has trapped the just right amount of heat to create a stable climate for us. Other planets don't have that same heat-trapping blanket. Mercury's is too thin, so it gets too hot in the sun and too cold when it's in the shade. Venus's blanket is so thick with greenhouse gases that it gets way too hot there. It would be impossible to live. But our Earth's blanket is just right. And right now, just like a quilt is different than a heavy blanket, we are changing the material of our blanket through our carbon pollution related to those 5 things. And we need to start reducing that pollution so that we don't trap more heat in that blanket.
Well, just to end on, I like this idea of talking to our kids about it at home, but then also how they can help at school. Do you have any resources for parents that, because I could, walking into my school building and saying to them, I want zero waste lunch, I would think that they would be like, okay, you do it. Come here every day.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. First of all, I should say in our book, Student Schools and Climate Moment, we're telling the stories of individuals in communities across the entire country that have started these conversations in their schools. And the biggest thing they've gone and done is just started the conversation, and then things continue. And I would recommend, if you go to thisisplaneted.org, we have toolkits that can help parents in starting these conversations with their schools. We have toolkits for educators, for school board members, for students themselves as well, to help them in leading these conversations with their schools and their school districts to advance action.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. We've been talking with Laura Shifter, Senior Fellow at the Aspen Institute and co-author of Students, Schools, and Our Climate Moment, Acting Now to Secure Our Future. Thank you for joining us, Laura.
Thanks so much, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk about how to end the cell phone dead zones. That's when Tech Tuesday continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich, and this is Tech Tuesday. If you've been out in rural parts of our country, chances are you've completely lost your cell phone signal. Not only can this be an inconvenience, but in the case of an emergency, it can be dangerous. T-Mobile and Starlink are working together to fight this. With the launch of their latest initiative, T-Satellite, they hope to eliminate dead zones for users. Joining us now to talk about it is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So the idea of ending dead zones seems both long overdue and also impossible at the same time. Can this really happen?
Well, it's important to understand that this concept of eliminating dead zones, while possible, only applies to text messages. So this is not a service where, you know, if you're in a dead zone, you'd be able to flip over to a satellite mode and place a phone call. But that is essentially what's happening here is we've got two generations at least for both iPhone and Android that now have some form of satellite support service. The last couple of Samsung phones have had it, Google's phones, Apple's phones, and there have been these limitations where it's largely used for emergency services. If you happen to find yourself in the middle of nowhere and you need to reach emergency services, this satellite feature would help you with that. T-Mobile is working with Starlink, but they're also working with AT&T and Verizon to have this direct-to-cell messaging service over satellite. So what that means is you're not sending a message over the T-Mobile network or the AT&T or Verizon network, but you're using Starlink satellite to send from one place to another.
So you can text 911 basically. If you're in a dead zone and you have an emergency, you can text 911 from your phone.
You can text 911. You'd be able to message friends and family to let them know that either you're safe or that, you know, you need help. And location data is included in the kind of information that can be shared, especially using the E911 service. So yes, this is effectively a way to stay within communication with folks. And unlike previous versions of satellite messaging features that have been available to phones, there's not currently a limit on how many messages can be sent within a certain period over the satellite service. The Starlink deal is kind of an unlimited ability to text. And if you are not on T-Mobile, immediately on some of the plans that will have this included, AT&T and Verizon customers can engage in this for $10 a month on top of their current plan.
I read in the CNET piece that Starlink has more than 7,000 low Earth orbit satellites in the sky, and 657 of them will be devoted entirely to T-Satellite. So first of all, 7,000 satellites just for Starlink. I think I am underestimating how many satellites are up there. Am I just clueless, or is this like just a small drop in the bucket of satellite world?
We could have an entire conversation about the way that satellites are being regularly launched in the space for services like this, and actually the impact they're having on our ability to observe the night sky.
Okay. Well, we'll save that for a different Tech Tuesday. But for now, so these satellites are what is making it work. So having 7,000 of them up there, 657 are being devoted to this system. Is that enough? Is it going to work everywhere? Are there truly going to be no dead zones?
This is the kind of thing where, Starlink is claiming that this number, the 657, is what is necessary in order to completely cover the globe and provide that service on a rolling basis. One of the things that, Starlink is used as a high-end broadband service. So folks who pay for full Starlink service, they essentially have the same speeds or faster in some cases as the kind of internet connection that you would have at home. Under that strain, being able to send a single text message is quite small as far as how much data gets, consumed and used there. So if Starlink is able to deliver a high-end broadband experience, then being able to send text messages, even at the volume of, US consumers, should be a fairly low lift, and something that this number of satellites theoretically can handle.
So the auditorium at my kid's school is like the middle of a desert in Utah. There is absolutely no service. Last night, my phone went into SOS mode during parent orientation. So if I pay $10 to Starlink, I have Verizon, so I'd have to pay the $10. Will it prevent this from happening? Can I send a text?
That is a really great question. One of the things that is quite common about satellite connections from our mobile phones is that things work best when there is a clear view of the night sky. However, if you were in that SOS mode and you could see the satellite icon on the top of your phone next to that SOS, then you would be able to use this service. But if that satellite icon is not there, then you would not have access to the texting features.
All right, so when can I get this satellite service for my Verizon phone and test it out in this auditorium that I spend a lot of time in?
This is something that is expected to roll out here within the next month, and we'll likely see, kind of more advertising and testing about this. But this is we'll see quite a bit, more on this here within the next 30 days.
I just need to send a text being like, I'm sitting on the left side, come find me. And you
That's
can't, and it
right.
won't go through. All right. Moving on to our next topic. Apple has a new watch coming out soon. But before that happens, there is an update that will work for some current customers, a blood oxygen monitor. So, Russell, if I'm understanding this correctly, some Apple Watch users could track their blood oxygen levels. They used to be able to, but it was disabled because of a lawsuit. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So there was the Apple Watch Series 9 and the Apple Watch Series 10, and Apple Watch Ultra 2 owners used to have something called the Blood Oxygen app that acted as a kind of consumer level pulse oximeter that let you know what your blood oxygen level was. The Apple made a ton of kind of very clarifying statements about how this is not something that should replace a visit to a doctor, but as a way of gathering additional information about your health as you go along. There was a patent dispute back in January of 2024 with a company called Masimo, claiming that Apple was using their technology in order to facilitate this blood oxygen function. The U.S. Customs legal department had a ruling that said that Apple was in violation of this patent, and so the features were not allowed to be included on those watches after that ruling. But this is something that the Trump administration is reversing this week, and is something that is going to be available by way of a software update here alongside the release of the Apple Watch Series 11.
Okay, I think my watch is too old for this, but I'll have to get a new one. But why would I want to track my blood oxygen level?
Blood oxygen is, it's a feature that is able to give you information if you are pre-diabetic. Or if you have heart conditions, it's really kind of another data point that is really useful to a medical professional, or as a way of kind of identifying what your current blood oxygen level is for working out. If you find that you wear it while you sleep and it says that your heart maybe isn't pumping as hard as it possibly could during that time, that's the kind of notification that Apple would send along with, hey, go take this information to your doctor so they can help you identify this trend. And it's really about kind of regularly gathering that data in order to determine either an increasing or decreasing trend.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we're talking with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Switching gears from Apple to Android now, some users will now receive sensitive content warnings that will obscure images with suspected nudity. What prompted this feature to be created?
So Google as a company has been working for quite some time on a suite of tools that it calls Safety Core. And this is kind of a variation on the conversation we had a couple of weeks ago about YouTube trying to find ways to prevent kids from accessing parts of YouTube that that kids probably shouldn't be on. The goal here is to make sure that anyone who would like this feature enabled, particularly when it comes to family members, are not at risk of being exposed to material being sent to them by way of a text message that parents wouldn't want them to see. So this function is something that is not enabled by default for adults, but it can be turned on. But it is something that is available through Google's Family Link service for kids ages 13 to 17.
Okay. So how does the software detect if a photo is inappropriate or not? I like
Well,
it just scans it or
yeah, so once the image reaches your phone, in very much the same way that your Google Photos app will take a look at an image in order to offer ways to enhance it, either by applying dynamic range or color corrections or like adjusting skin tone and things like that, where it will automatically recommend those settings. That same piece of software is able to detect things like body parts. And if a range of body parts is deemed, as a part of Google's warning system, then those can be used as a sort of filter for those images, so that by the time it acts, quite quickly, so by the time the image is actually available in the Messages app, the software will have already applied that warning and blurred the image, so that it cannot be viewed.
Does Apple have something similar?
Apple does not currently have something similar. Apple has maintained kind of a privacy position where being able to have software like this on your phone kind of violates what Apple views as personal privacy rules, because it means that, the software is kind of constantly monitoring things on your phone.
Okay. Well, and now, as they say, for something completely different, the final topic that you sent me this week that is Halloween related. So even though it's still August, we'll be talking about Halloween before we know it. And something that has been very popular in recent years is putting a giant skeleton in your front yard. So now Home Depot wants to scare your dog walking neighbors even more by making that skeleton talk. Why do we need a talking skeleton, Russell?
Yes, so this has honestly been something that I'm not sure Home Depot as a company knew was going to be as popular as it was. It started out with a single, very generic 12-foot skeleton, and every year for the last 5 years, there has been this, right around this time every year, there's been a new release. Sometimes they are giant pets. Sometimes they are, I think last year one of the releases was Jack Skellington from Nightmare Before Christmas, but also 12 feet tall. And so this one for this year leans into, being a little more dynamic. So there are pieces here that will move around. The head will actually move and track motion as people walk by. So if you have a sidewalk that people walk by, it's possible for the head to be set to actually track people as they walk by, with eyes inside of the skeleton that blink and a bunch of LEDs everywhere to give, kind of spooky effects. But what is particularly different this year is you can have up to five preset recordings of audio that are up to 30 seconds long each, that will either modulate your voice or play, audio from something else, also as people go to walk by.
Well, that's not creepy at all. Yay.
And it's all controlled from your phone, so you have the ability to really play with your neighbors quite a bit this year.
Now, the pre-recorded messages, but I also saw, isn't there live chatting, like kind of like how you can chat through your Ring doorbell?
That's exactly right. As long as you're within reasonable connection of your a Wi-Fi service, you have to make sure that your skeleton has good Wi-Fi, or a stable Bluetooth connection. Then it would allow you to interact with it in real time. And I can really just imagine, a guy kind of camping out in his bushes with his phone nearby in order to scare his wife as she comes home from work. I have a feeling we're going to see a number of those videos here as these start to become available.
Now, this skeleton is not 12 feet tall, though. The talking, moving one is a little bit smaller. Is that right?
That is correct. This is 6.5 feet tall, which honestly makes it easier to put things like clothes on, should you decide that your
Oh,
skeleton
no.
is an all-year skeleton and
Yeah.
can be dressed up for Christmas and Easter and things like that. But yeah, this is something that is designed to live outside. It is supposed to be nice and weatherproof, and with all of the electronics built into it, is going to cost $280.
Yeah, that was my next question. How much? I don't know how much the 12-foot skeleton costs. I have not bought one. So is it more than the 12-foot one?
All of these end up being a couple $100s. Mm-hmm. They kind of vary depending on which version you're looking for. But this is pretty well in line with what you would expect to pay for one of the larger skeletons that don't have all of the smart features attached to it.
Now, I didn't realize that Home Depot kind of had the market on these skeletons. Do they have like some sort of patent, or do other stores, Lowe's and Targets and such, have giant skeletons too?
We get to this time of year and all of the hardware stores have some, kind of giant inflatable decorations or things like that. But this particular brand of skeletons, which are affectionately called Skelly by Home Depot, that is something that is unique to that brand.
Okay. So, what do you think? You know, we have like 30 seconds left. Do you think that the pre-recorded messages, the live chatting, will go to the 12-foot skeleton next? Is that the next?
It wouldn't surprise me, but I think in order to do that, the skeleton, that particular skeleton, will end up being a little over $500. and I think that they're probably smart to keep the price as low as they reasonably can. Given the state of the world right now.
All right. Well, maybe. Hopefully, they can make people laugh instead of completely scaring them. Right? There's a balance there.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I want to say thank you to Russell Holley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks for joining us, Russell.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And I want to be sure to tell everyone to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Instagram. Our Instagram handle is @AllSidesWOSU. That way you can see some behind-the-scenes photos. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen at WOSU.org/AllSides. Subscribe to the podcast. Every episode is also available for free in the WOSU mobile app. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.